listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update on the continuing developments in Nicaragua with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, speaking with us from Managua, Nicaragua. We've been talking for the last couple of weeks about the violence that started in April that seems to be coordinate with the political effort in the United States to destabilize the government, even calling for regime change.
It's a very complicated situation, Don, and there's so many variables. It's hard to keep track of everything, but and the one fundamental thing is to understand that whatever is happening here in Nicaragua, that it is not in any way faithfully reflected in reporting in North America and Europe. I mean, the corporate media and much of the alternative media there live in a kind of bizarro world, a kind of through-the-looking-glass world, where everything's back to front. So here... the police stations get attacked by opposition paramilitaries, but that turns into the police attacking the paramilitaries. People are harassed and intimidated by opposition thugs, but that turns into Sandinista mobs intimidating innocent students, and that's right. We've been here before. We saw in Ukraine, we saw in Libya, it's a constant thing in Syria, and a complete reversal of the reality on the ground.
Well, you know what I saw happen in Libya, actually? Rather than it being through the looking glass, it was more like through the window of the hotel. Because right. I was talking with people who were on the streets in Tripoli, for example, while that stuff was going on, and they would report to me what's happening, you know, in this part of town, that part of town, or whatever, then you would see these other reports, and they would, it was, you know, at the Corinth Hotel or, you know, the Bab al-Bashar Hotel or whatever, and you find out from people that are staying there that these reporters have never left the hotel since they got there last Tuesday or whatever. So that's what the basis of the reports were.
Yeah, and even if they do and visit Nicaragua, even if reporters from Western media do visit Nicaragua, they only ever talk to the opposition. You'll never get. Then there's not even an attempt anymore at what used to be called balance. Forget it. And so, then what is happening here? Well, the protests started on April the 18th, peaceful protests. Within 24 hours, they were hijacked by opposition paramilitaries. And then you had a series of attacks on municipal officers, attacks against police, attacks against the buildings of the FSLN, the Sandinista Party, and nothing to do with peaceful protests. Right. And so the original pretext for those protests was the Social Security reform. The Social Security reform was proposed, but it was withdrawn within 3 or 4 days by President Ortega.
Right.
And that should have stopped the protests. But no, the protests continued because they had nothing to do with that detail of the Social Security reform. It's a regime change operation.
Right.
The opposition, the minority opposition here, want Ortega out. Now, President Ortega asked the Roman Catholic Church hierarchy to mediate a dialogue. And everything that happened between the date of that request, Sunday, April 22nd, I think it was, and right up to when the bishops actually finally set a date for the dialogue to start on May 11th. Everything that happened between then, there was an attempt by the opposition, including the Catholic bishops themselves, to sabotage the dialogue by setting up impossible preconditions, trying to provoke violence, and successfully provoking violence, inviting a repressive response from the police, in order to be able to say, oh, well, we can't hold a dialogue in these conditions because of police repression. But ever since April the 23rd, the police took a very, very low profile, doing the minimum necessary to maintain some semblance of public order. And then on May the 11th, one of the preconditions that the bishops set was that the police completely withdraw to their barracks, or to what are called the police delegations here in Nicaragua. And they did that, and that much to the surprise of the opposition, because they thought that request would be rejected and give them a pretext to continue the violence and avoid the dialogue. But that didn't happen. The dialogue started, and it became absolutely clear in the various sessions of the dialogue that happened, that neither the opposition nor the bishops really wanted the dialogue to succeed. And then eventually, despite the government bending over backwards to be conciliatory and maintain the dialogue, the bishops just shut it down. And so, and when did that happen? That happened about, 2 weeks ago now? Yep. And so, at that point, the opposition hoped that they'd be able to garner international support and international condemnation of the Nicaraguan government. But the non-violent strategy, and Nicaragua is the only country in the world where opposition forces attack the police with firearms and the police have orders not to shoot back. Can you tell me another country in the world where that is?
Not just that. I mean, I noted before, one of the first things you said was, when we look at through the distorted lens of the U.S. media, that when you have paramilitary groups attack the police, that they report here that the police are attacking paramilitary groups. But where else in the world are you allowed to assemble paramilitary groups in the first place without them being attacked by police? Because a paramilitary formulation is, you know, in itself an armed criminal violation.
Yeah. So and what the government is saying here is that we could clear the roadblocks and we could repress the opposition paramilitaries in very, very quick order if we deployed the army. But we're not going to deploy the army. We don't want to win another war. We want to win a peace. That is the line of the government. Right. And they're... And although whatever the opposition media say, and that gets retailed endlessly in Western corporate media, and the government is committed to some kind of non-violent solution to the protest, and they only deploy over the weekend. They had to deploy some police special units to defend a police station where opposition paramilitaries were using heavy mortars, not the handheld mortars that have become so familiar in the photographs of what's happening here, but they've manufactured big diameter mortars that they were using to try and break down the walls of the police station in Masaya. No, I know, and it is an extraordinary situation, Don, because it's just unprecedented for a government anywhere not to deploy its security forces to maintain public order. But the reason that they're not doing it is because that's what the political opposition here want. So then, they've been constantly frustrated by the government's non-violent policy of not deploying the security forces. And so what the opposition have had to do is to mount attacks because they need deaths. They need death to be able to project an image of government repression in Nicaragua. So they have to carry out attacks. Then again, against targets, usually Sandinista targets, the in self-defense, not just Sandinista targets, against the general population too, they attack ordinary businesses. And so ordinary people and including Sandinista supporters act in self-defense. And of course, as a result, there are going to be deaths and injuries,
right,
which is exactly what the opposition want.
This is what we saw in Venezuela also.
Yeah, exactly. So and as many friends in Venezuela have communicated to me, they see what's happening in Nicaragua as a carbon copy of what happened in Venezuela, with the difference that the government here is desperate to avoid wider bloodshed. Now, if you look at the reports, it looks as though the whole country is, you know, up in flames or something. But that's not the case. And the roadblocks are only active in something like 20 of Nicaragua's 153 municipalities. And little by little, the government is, by means of negotiation, in some ways they've learned a lot. They seem to have learned a lot from Syria. Instead of trying to deploy firepower from the security forces to eradicate the opposition, what they're trying to do is to negotiate local agreements, so as to dismantle the roadblocks that are strangling economic life. And slowly try and get the country back to normal. But let me get back to what happened last week.
Yeah.
And as a result of the government's policy of not deploying the security forces and insisting on non-violence and trying to achieve a peaceful solution, the opposition have intensified their violence at the same time as they hoped for a victory in the Organization of American States, getting countries to condemn Nicaraguan government repression. But they completely failed. On the diplomatic front, they've completely failed. The Organization of American States issued a statement in support, not of the government of Nicaragua, but of Nicaragua, hoping for a peaceful resolution to the country's crisis. Right. The European Union has issued a statement hoping that Nicaragua will be able to resolve its crisis peacefully via dialogue. The United Nations Secretary General.
Yep, I saw that.
Dujarric
last week read exactly that kind of statement. As a matter of fact, I was surprised when I, because when I looked and I saw that there was a statement contained in his press conference like last Wednesday or Thursday, I forget what it was, and I played it because assuming, you know, normally it's a pro-U.S. perspective that comes out of their mouth. I was shocked pretty much at how even-handed it was. And it's even mischievous to be even-handed, honestly, when you have an external assault with, internal agency against a popular government. With a president who was elected with 72.5% of the vote only, 16 months, 18 months ago.
Yeah, in 2016, into right. 2016.
November 6th, yep.
Anyway, what has been the result of that resounding diplomatic defeat for the Nicaraguan opposition? Well, they're intensifying the violence, and the bishops here have completely dropped whatever mask they had assumed of impartiality. You know, I think it was last week, last Thursday or Friday, they gave, oh no, it was, it might have been on Wednesday, but sometime last week, and they gave what amounted to an ultimatum to Daniel Ortega, although the contents of the letter that they gave him weren't made public. It seems very clear that they gave him an ultimatum saying they wanted him to resign, right?
So,
And in the churches here, the bishops are openly encouraging people to take part in protests and roadblocks and opposition activity. And so the Catholic Church here is completely discredited. And they've actually, in doing that, they're actually in rebellion against what Pope Francis has more or less told them to do. And they... Instead of mediating dialogue and promoting peace, they're actively promoting, although they're very careful to stay just this side of advocating the outright violence, they're openly promoting the opposition activities that inevitably lead to violence. So what happened over the weekend here? There was an attack on another police station down about 40 kilometers south of us in a place called Sebeco. The night before, they attacked a police station and stole 5 semi-automatic AK-47s and kidnapped 3 police officers who thankfully have now been released after being very badly beaten up. In Hinatega, they've got police kidnapped and they're so in your face, blatant, that they actually published videos of how they tortured those police on the social media, and it is the situation is so extraordinary, Don, that it's difficult to find the words to describe it. But so here, people are well aware of what the opposition are, but they're just delinquents. And if you on the roadblocks and the people in the paramilitaries, these aren't students; these are paramilitary thugs and delinquents. Now, if you look at the components of, if you say, well, who are the people behind the opposition? Currently, it's absolutely clear that where we are, for example, the Catholic Church are supporting the roadblocks, you know, helping them with food and just general logistics. And the same is true down in Masaya. They're so open about it that camionettas will arrive to deliver supplies to the roadblocks. I'm flying the yellow and white flag, which is the flag of the Catholic Church here in Nicaragua.
Right.
And the Catholic Church is now openly supporting the opposition. The bishops openly support the opposition. And there's no attempt to hide that. So who is allied with the opposition apart from the Catholic Church? Well, right-wing sectors of the business community. Not all by any means, but the most right-wing sectors of the business community who just want... all those leftists that accuse Daniel Ortega of implementing neoliberal policies need to explain why it is that the most right-wing sectors here in Nicaragua are trying to oust Daniel Ortega.
And Washington, by the way.
Right. And so... Sorry, Don.
No, I'm just laughing. I'm saying and Washington.
Right.
Yeah.
So and also and I, let, I'm talking about the internal supporters for the opposition.
No, I understand. I understand.
It's the Catholic Church,
right.
The right-wing sectors of the business community, organized crime, which is very obvious, and that's been clear that when the police broke up a gang of delinquents responsible for various murders and various attacks on public and private property in Managua, that gang was based in the private Upoli University, the Polytechnic University in Managua.
Gotcha.
So although some students may have been associated with that gang, the main driving force behind the most extreme violence is organized crime. And those people, the people that were arrested, three people were arrested, they were linked to Mexican organized crime, and also they were linked directly to the opposition Sandinista Renewal Movement, the MRS. And that's one of the reasons. And there's a guy called Felix Maradiago, who's a very strongly associated with the MRS. And he was actually named in that police report as being responsible for organizing some of the logistics of that gang of murderers and arsonists.
Surprise, surprise.
So, he actually accused Luis Almagro of being an accomplice of Daniel Ortega. You know, that's the kind of mentality that these people have. And he put out a video over the weekend of himself saying that he decided not to return to Nicaragua because the police had circulated an arrest warrant for him.
Yeah.
And he kind of projects that as if that's something to be proud of. Mind the mentality of the opposition here is really extraordinary. They seem to think that the mere fact that they're trying to overthrow a government that happens not to be entirely to the liking of the United States government gives them license to do absolutely commit any crime.
Yep.
At that point in the discussion, you can then start talking about, well, what foreign support do the minority Nicaraguan opposition here have? And of course, they have the complete backing of Marco Rubio, Ileana Ros Letterman, right. Bob Menendez, and all those right-wing Cuban politicians.
Right.
Cuban-American politicians.
Menendez, all of them.
Who are such great friends of the region's super terrorist Luis Posada Carriles, who died recently.
Right. Yep.
So it's no surprise that they are promoting terrorist opposition violence, paramilitary violence here in Nicaragua. But the thing that's something of an unknown is what really is the position of the United States government. I know that United States foreign policy is kind of almost impossible to decipher because it's so erratic. And that applies here in Nicaragua, because you'd expect Donald Trump and Mike Pence to have gone much more strongly in the Organization of American States for a condemnation of Nicaragua than they actually did. It's one reason that they didn't succeed is because most opinion in among other Latin American governments was against any condemnation of Nicaragua. But another reason that people suggest here is that, I'm not sure how seriously to take this, is that the United States government does not want Nicaragua to be completely destroyed, like in social terms, and taken over by organized crime, because that would unleash a massive wave of migration into the United States.
Well, there's a number of things that are playing here. That, first of all, I mean, when you talk about what kind of things are being done by the U.S. government, there's the NECA Act, which has been in process for a couple of years now, and as a matter of fact, is not an initiative of the White House, but rather of members of Congress, Rubio and Ileana and others. She, by the way, is still in Congress till the end of the year.
Right.
She's just not going to run for re-election again as things stand. Menendez, all of those characters, you know, driving that kind of policy. And, of course, you do have Bolton in the White House now, which, you know, he was the architect of the last troubles that Nicaragua faced back in the 80s, in the late 70s, right. Early 80s. Or certainly one of the architects and certainly one of the engineers, operating engineers that did it. You also have in play, though, the same dynamic that you see operating elsewhere, and in fact, today and tomorrow and over the next week or two, most likely in Korea, where the White House, which did promise, even at the RNC, no more regime change, may make really strong rhetorical statements at the UN and elsewhere that seem to run counter to that. But in fact, take no action whatsoever or anything of any real material consequence to advance it, and are instead being driven from behind by the Congress. You look at the sanctions, for example, that were imposed on Russia and Iran and DPRK by the Congress, with a vote of 400 and something out of 500, you know, in both houses, like 90%, I think, or 85% in favor of those, without any initiative from the White House, in essence directing the president, trying to force the president to add sanctions to those that already existed. And there was not an active pushback from the White House, looking at the political, you know, just the numbers, that would have been foolish for them to do it. But the implementation has been very slow. And so you got to wonder where Trump really falls on the question, forgetting the obvious thing that you refer to, which is the consequence for the immigration policy he's so concerned about.
And for their kind of so-called war on drugs, you know.
Yeah.
Going back to the domestic situation here, and what's now that the Catholic Church is completely discredited, it's extremely unlikely that the dialogue will be reactivated with them as mediators. They may well take part as a key part of the opposition. Any dialogue that's likely to happen over the next couple of weeks is likely to be mediated by some other body,
right.
Possibly the Organization of American States itself, possibly the System for Central American Integration structure,
right.
And we don't. But the one key thing to understand is that, and my interpretation, insofar as, you know, it's possible to make any prediction at all, and I think that the government is absorbing a lot of punishment in terms of death and destruction, in order to avoid a broader civil conflict. And I think that policy is winning it and has won it support from the great majority of people in Nicaragua. The great majority of people in Nicaragua want a peaceful solution arrived at via dialogue. And as the opposition intensify their violence, and as they become more extreme, that seems to me to be a sign of their desperation, because they know that time's running out. For example, and just one basic thing to give an idea of their difficulties. To begin with, they were paying delinquents about, what was it, $10 a day, maybe $10 to $15 a day, to engage in the violent provocations at the very start of this, back in mid-April. Now they're having to pay delinquents $30 to $40 a day to operate the roadblocks. So that is not sustainable. And so the opposition are desperate. They're intensifying the violence. We're in a very dangerous phase here in Nicaragua, because the opposition are so desperate. But it's very likely that within a couple of weeks, their attempted coup d'etat will run out of steam. They'll be forced to negotiate, and who knows what the outcome will be? It'll depend on how the negotiations go. But it seems very clear that there's no way that this government is going to resign. They've adopted a policy of non-violence and opting for peace via dialogue that has the support of the vast majority of people in Nicaragua. And the minority opposition here are likely to suffer what could turn out to be a historic defeat again. And we'll see.
You know, we're almost out of time, but one thing I'd like to just at least mention, and we can discuss it another time. You have reported to us before the fact that Daniel Ortega is actually involved in one of the evangelical religions that are part of the landscape in Nicaragua. You know, formerly right. Latin America was the exclusive domain of the Catholic Church. that's changed over the last decades, and that includes in Nicaragua. The working classes and you know the laboring classes, the poor, were always the domain of the Catholic Church, and now you're seeing the local church hierarchy, in any event, staking out a position, you know, in opposition to them and siding with the you know masters, the landlords, the you know capital, and apparently global capital and/or the Catholic Church have decided that they should take a different stance when they brought Pope Francis to Rome in the first place from Latin America and you know painted him as a champion of peace and working people. So I'm wondering, in general, when the dust settles, what's going to be the consequence for the Catholic Church among the majority of the population?
It's very clear that the Catholic Church is going to suffer a lot of, and many Sandinistas don't go to church now. Here in Nicaragua is a very religious country. But even 3 or 4 years ago, it was clear that the Catholic Church has less than 50% of the devotion of the overall population. Evangelical churches have over 50% now. And when the dust settles, as you say, the church is going to suffer a marked loss of support. And one thing to bear in mind is that here in Nicaragua, the evangelical churches are not associated necessarily with the right wing.
Right.
There's always been a very strong progressive element. Dr. Gustavo Parajon, who was a leader of the Protestant church back in evangelical churches back in the 80s. Yeah. And it's the legacy of people like Parajon that has made it possible for the evangelical church to develop and with as successfully as it has.
And we're going to have to stop there. We are completely out of time. But I'd like to probe this some more. And Tony, thank you very much for your time, as always.
Okay, you're very welcome, John.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. The football fever is coming to Russia, and the kickoff to the tournament is just a few days away. This Russia World Cup will see new technologies, debutant teams, and new management. How will it all work out, and what does it mean for global football? Well, who better to ask than longtime FIFA president Sepp Blatter.
Football, the greatest global spectacle, is getting on with the times. Video assistant referee system is being rolled out this World Cup, and the next tournament will see ever more teams compete for the ultimate sports prize. Will these plans benefit football or overcomplicate it? Will the World Cup become bloated and diluted, or more exciting and diverse? And what else is in store for the great game?
It's really great to have you on our program one more time. Welcome. It's a pleasure to be here with you. So we've got a lot to talk about. World Cup coming up to Russia, and you, your persona and your role in FIFA and just football in general. I know that you have said you created the modern football, and while you were doing this, you made mistakes. What were those mistakes?
Well, I would say it a little bit different. I made errors, and the errors that I made, the biggest one was in by conducting the FIFA and being the boss of FIFA. There is a matter how to manage such an organization. And as I'm started in this organization in 1975, when FIFA was just a very small organization with 11 people, I was a number 12. I went through all the FIFA, first as a development officer, technical director, secretary general, CEO, and then the president. So I grew up with this FIFA. My biggest error was then, when I was elected in 98, difficult election, 2002 again with a problem. Then I got the position and I trusted people. And I trusted people so much that at the end, I was betrayed. I have to accept to be betrayed by people from the executive because I couldn't choose them because they were not always on my. But what was for me, and this has harmed me, but this was this when you say mistake, error, to trust all these people and to not realize that.
That's a mistake that a lot of people make in politics, in business, and industry. I really just want to talk a little more about the impact that you've had on the game itself, on football itself, not the organization FIFA, but what we see in everyday football. Because I know you've said, I've created modern football. Is it maybe taken a little too far? I mean, you came up with these amazing new rules, but the innovations, shouldn't the players and other managers also take credit for that?
Well, the part of football, and I'm happy you came back on the field of play with your question, because I'm more comfortable on the field of play. That's the definite. I was a good player. I was not a star player, but I was a good player. What I have seen in football when I started. To think about development of football, then I have realized that football is more than kicking a ball. Football is more than that. But to be more, you have to organize the game. And the game was not organized. The game was only for Europe and was for South America. And then to go worldwide, and then we had to have a look on the laws of the game. How are the laws of the game? And then the laws, they have to be adapted to the development of the game. The game became faster, and then we have realized after the World Cup in Italy in 90. Italia 90.
It was a very boring World Cup, I remember. It was only defendants playing.
Yeah, defending, and the back pass to the goalkeeper. At the line, you had referees at the line. They wouldn't participate with the referee in the center. I was the secretary general, and then we have installed the so-called FIFA 2000, a group of specialists, to change the laws.
How did that work? Yeah, I remember you put a group together to make a football more combative and more, you know, exciting. How did that group work exactly? What did they do?
It worked because everybody has realized, the coaches, the players, the media, even the referees have realized that they were wrong to have referees at the line, because to be a linesman or to be a referee is different. The linesman is a judge. The referee is a referee. He has to say yes or no. The other one has in or out. So, and then to see that the match was lasting less than 30 minutes, the whole match in the game when it was played, because this back pass to the goalkeepers and then the non-respect of the strikers going and being then tackled from behind by saying, oh, it's nothing or it's just a yellow card. So we had to change that. And this was a big issue or a discussion. And we had players also with us at that time. I already took Michel Platini in this matter. And really... so fast. Never the international board has changed the rule. Then from one World Cup to the other, we have made different changes. The game was then 4 years later in the United States was then faster. Already at the first matches, the people or players have been red carded because of it was called the foul play of last instance before outside of the 16 of the 18 yards line, and also we had now linesmen on the line, and thanks to the British, we have to say, we have changed the scoring. It means the evaluation of the score, 3 points for a win, to say let's go to win and not only 2 points in and so on. So this was the biggest change that have been made in the laws of the game.
Talk to me about the players of today. I mean, you also have called them modern-day slaves, but these people are making millions of euros and dollars per week. I mean, the transfer fees, they're just nuts. They're getting bigger and bigger. Records are broken every year. I don't see how football players are at a disadvantage here and how they're modern-day slaves. Maybe you know something I don't. And I know that you didn't like this whole transfer fee mania, where like hundreds of millions of euros or dollars were poured in one player, and you wanted to change that, but that didn't happen. So this transfer system, the way we see it right now, is this the only way for football, or do you think it's still going to be changed in the future?
No, it cannot be changed because it is based on the so-called offer and demand of economic principles, and that you cannot change. The only thing what FIFA, not FIFA, the UEFA tried to do is to introduce this system called financial fair play, say, financial fair play. In finances, there are no fair play. Finances, there are accounts. But, and then to make a rule that and a club should not have in between the income and the expenses, there should not be a great gap, and where is the money coming from? But this is the same rule where they cannot be successful.
So I know that you're not a big fan of the video assistant referee, and it's going to be the first time during World Cup 2018 in Russia that it's going to be used at this level of competition. I've spoken to the organizers, and they're actually saying that it's tested, it's working really well, and it's going to make judgment in football a lot easier. What are your reservations? What's the reason you mistrust it?
I don't mistrust that we shall develop also refereeing, and we have started to have the goal line technology, but it took 3 years until it was introduced, because before you introduce a very important change in the laws of the game, there must be some experiences made around the world. This is a principle of this International Football Association board. But now, and I was out then of FIFA, they have now put in the so-called VAR, video assistant referee. And this is not exactly what, personally, we have asked the television to do. We have not asked television to be the referee of the game. And so I said, it is not time for a World Cup to make such an experiment. Before going to make an experiment in the World Cup, it shall be done in the different other competitions and worldwide competition. That can be the youth competition, the women's competition, in order to see how it's happened. Because now you have the majority of the referees, they are now in the World Cup, they have never worked with this system. And you have also the majority of the players there, they have never worked with this system. So how? So that's why I put a question mark behind that, and I was not criticizing FIFA in this that they said we do it. I was criticizing the international board, the guardians of the laws of the game. Why you have permitted to do that? But now it's done, and then let's see what will happen.
We're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to Sepp Blatter. We'll talk about football and how it is perceived in today's world and the upcoming World Cup. Stay with us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And we're back with Sepp Blatter. Obviously, when power is changed, whoever comes into power brings new sets of rules, new teams. So your successor after in FIFA also brought a new team. He changed everyone completely. Most of the people in power are now former football players. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know what FIFA needs, whether football players or ex-coaches or good managers. Maybe you can tell me. But also, FIFA wants to create an extended version of FIFA Club World Cup that would be held every 4 years and 24 club teams would take part. I don't really understand the logic behind it. I mean, FIFA explains that this is actually a great idea. It will bring more competition to the game, will make it more interesting for the fans. Couple of points that I want to ask you about. First of all, the football players. I mean, wouldn't they be so tired of playing these endless tournaments? Because there are just so many of them, you know. FIFA World Cup, the Regional Championship, Champions League, Confederation Cup, Olympic Games. Don't they need to also train and rest? Second of all, the fans. I mean, it's great to have a lot of competitions, but wouldn't that also dilute their attention from the main thing, which is the World Cup? Yeah? And also, why would anyone want to give up, you know, their money? I'm talking about the UEFA clubs. Why would they want to be part of the FIFA World Club? Why?
The FIFA World Cup is still number one in the world of any sporting event. And it is in popularity five times more popular than Olympic Games.
That's definitely undoubtable. That's what I said. I'm talking about the FIFA Club World Cup
yes,
that they want
to But I come
create.
To that because it's at the end of the question was, will the World Cup suffer? The World Cup will not suffer.
No matter what.
Not matter what. But the international calendar, it was so difficult to bring an international calendar together. And now with new competitions in this international calendar, that's a nonsense because then we are in the Gregorian calendar with 365 days. So we should ask to have somebody, another calendar with 500 days. And then it would be possible. And it is absolutely, absolutely on the social point of view, it will always be the same clubs, the same players. The players, they cannot... It's impossible. They have no more time to rest. And if they have no more time to rest, then they are injured and they are out. And this is a non-respect to the actors on the field of play. That's first of all. Secondly, the fans, at a certain time, they will have enough. They will have enough because they open a television. There is always football, soccer, all around the world. And there are so many competitions. And which competition will then suffer the most if all this will be done? The National League. And the football is, first of all, because it's a national football, National League. And if they try, even now in Europe, they try... to put the good matches of the Champions League at the end of the week. And at the end of the week has always been for the national football, not only the professional football, amateur football and all those. They play at the end of the week. And it's a non-respect. This idea is a non-respect to the players. It's a non-respect to the fans. And finally, it's a non-respect to the organization of football. Football is organized through national association. FIFA is an assembly or a confederation of national associations.
So I get the 2 points, thank you. And the third point is about the clubs that operate inside their own federations, like Champions League is part of UEFA. Why would they ever want to give up their revenues to FIFA and be part of this new FIFA Club World Cup, for instance?
Well, so far, and until the end of 2015, finances in FIFA, they were well. I was very happy and proud to lead FIFA with 2.4 billion, 1.4 in reserves, and 1 billion in cash. But now FIFA needs more money. They need more money because they have changed the management of FIFA. They have another approach, new president. He has another view how to organize FIFA. As you have said, with former footballers, that's okay. But the former footballers, they need also the schooling to be in the position they are now, and how they get it with other people they're in. So it is because FIFA is looking for more money that they are coming with these new ideas. And there is somewhere this offer from a consortium of banks and it is speaking about Japan, Saudi Arabia, USA. They have put together $25 billion to get these two competitions.
Middle East and Asian countries. Yeah, they've put 25. They want to invest $25 billion to actually reform FIFA.
Yeah, to buy out to two competitions. But you cannot buy competitions.
So that would be like a first time that you're selling competitions to a third party. Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
No. We have never. In my 41 years in FIFA, we have never sold any competition to a third party.
So if this happens, they're going to own FIFA and they will be able to say where they want the competitions to be held, right?
Yeah, sure, you cannot. The football belongs not to FIFA, belongs not to UEFA. The football belongs to the 2 billion fans around the world. This is where the football belongs. And you cannot sell out part of football to another entity. This is also from the philosophic point of view, how you organize football and the importance, the social, cultural importance of this game, putting people together, but not abusing this game. It is abusing this game and abusing, I would say, players, coaches, everybody, and the fans.
Talk to me about this possible investment of $25 billion into FIFA reform. I find it fascinating. If you were right now active president of FIFA, you wouldn't take in those $25 billion to reform FIFA.
No, I would not sell out FIFA for such an investment. If they want to give the FIFA $25 million, but telling this for development of football, do it what the best you can do, then I would take it.
$25 billion always comes with strings attached.
Yeah, but,
it doesn't come
but
as
nobody
a bonus.
Is giving $25 million for nothing. And then now it's up to the FIFA to decide on that. But I'm not convinced because it's a new era in FIFA. But I think this is absolutely wrong. This is absolutely wrong.
So I just want to ask you a question about the World Cup that's going to take place in Russia. I know that 6 countries have boycotted the World Cup, but they're not sending politicians and representatives, but they're still sending their teams. It's not like it's going to have any bearing on the competition itself. So what is the point of this kind of a boycott? Is it going to affect the World Cup in Russia in any way?
No, I cannot, and I am not so sure if at the end they are not coming, all this. I'm not so sure. We will see if by any chance the FA team, England, will do well and is going to quarterfinal or final, then the people in London, they will be on their chairs and say, we have to go. And to announce a boycott and a competition because of the geopolitical situation in the world. Let football bring people together. And I'm sure that this World Cup will be an exceptional good World Cup on the field of play, but also for the image, for FIFA, the image of Russia, to show that they are able to organize the World Cup. But Russia has been in the past years now, so much under pressure, but there was never a very concrete demand that the World Cup shall not be played there. Although they don't like that the World Cup is in Russia, they were thinking twice or three times to say, no, we should not go there, we should boycott it. No, that would not be good. That would not be good because it's not only the football, it's a powerhouse there. It is Russia a powerhouse. And here, football and politics is together. It's the World Cup that gives now Russia more power, and this powerhouse cannot be just boycotted. And if they are not, those they are not there, okay, they have lost something.
So the 2026 World Cup will also have more teams competing. It's going to be 48 versus 32. The problem with that, in my opinion, is that with more teams comes much more of a boring games. I mean, it's one thing to watch France and Argentina. Everyone wants to watch it. But, like, who wants to watch, I don't know, Malaysia and Saudi Arabia playing? There's going to be, like, much more games like that. I mean, you told me yourself in the 90s there was, like, one of the most boring World Cups. How do you make sure that more teams don't mean more boring football?
That's wrong.
What's wrong?
To play with 48 teams. Absolutely wrong. The number of 32 has now acquired a system to play in 30 days, 31 days, and where definitely the best, or then by any bad chance, like Italy and Netherlands for this time, are out. But 48 teams will dilute the quality, that's first. And secondly, the other problem is they want to play in groups by three. And we have already played in groups by three in Spain, the second part of the World Cup 82, when for the first time we had 24 teams. And when you have groups by three, you have always a spectator. One is not playing. So the last match in the group by three, it is open for all possible bad thoughts that are around the world when you speak about football and you speak about fixed matches or whatever. But to play with your groups by three is absolutely wrong, totally wrong.
You're coming to the World Cup to see the tournaments. What do you expect to see? I mean, who are you going to root for? I mean, obviously the Swiss are going to be champions, but who do you think is going to take the silver? So,
okay.
Who are you rooting for?
Presidente Amanda. No. Now I'm a guest of Mr. Putin, President Putin. I am happy, or I'm honored to be invited, and I'll be there. But anyway, I have my opinion on the teams that would be at the best at the end.
Who?
I have four teams. But I don't put them in 1-4. I put them together.
Just four favorites. Who are they?
The four teams are Brazil. Brazil, alphabetic order, Brazil. France, Germany, Spain.
No Argentina?
No.
Okay. No. So let's wait and see. Thank you so much for this wonderful interview. So much for the Swiss. We're expecting you to see you in Russia.
With great pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.